This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a new world travel alert for Americans. French President Hollande seeks international support for attacks on Islamic State militants. Urban farming gets results.
If you have a wall that's nice and sunny, we'll put a nice sturdy trellis up the wall and grow something like beans or cucumbers or peas, make use of that vertical space. On a balcony, we'd use some containers. We've even used 5-gallon buckets.
The First Lady of Country Music is recognized once more. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The U.S. government late Monday issued a worldwide travel alert. It says current information suggests that Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and other terrorist groups continue to plan terrorist attacks in multiple regions. All U.S. citizens are being urged to remain vigilant when in public places or using transportation. International Edition's Victor Beatty spoke with Luke Howie, Deputy Director of the Global Research Center at Monash University in Australia, who says it's a more advanced move than seen previously.
Certainly, there was a time where we felt the Al-Qaeda threat would be hard to top, and ISIS has certainly done that in droves. I mean, these are the sort of precautions one takes when one starts to feel fear and anxiety in relation to the terrorist threat. I think the reality is the threat is not necessarily greater than it was 3 months ago. We just have a different awareness of what that threat might mean at this present moment in time. ISIS are buoyed by recent successes, what would be viewed in their organization as successes, and they're probably going to look to capitalize on those successes by carrying out more spectacular attacks. So I wouldn't call the move extraordinary. I'd call it a natural reaction, perhaps, to terrorism, a political tactic designed to cause fear and anxiety in us all. But we must always balance the desire to be safe and secure and with that awareness that the more we give in to what ISIS demands and what it wants us to do to live in fear, to change our behaviour, the more we're sort of kicking an own goal, to borrow a soccer metaphor, the more we sort of play into their hands. So a balance is needed. I think, yes, we need to take precautions when we travel, but we also need to realise our lives are there to be lived, and to issue travel warnings is one born a little bit of anxiety. But then again, that's what terrorists want us to do, and that's what terrorism is designed to do as well.
The announcement cites attacks in France, Nigeria, Denmark, Turkey, and Mali over the past year as the justification for such an alert. Do you see Islamic State, which is dominating the news on all points these days, really gelling as a global terror threat?
Yes, they are gelling as a global terror threat, but we must always be, we should never think of this in organizational terms. The prevailing metaphor when talking about Al-Qaeda 10 or 11 years ago was that they're a bit like a Hydra-type organization. I mean Hydra in the Greek, the mythological figure, not in the James Bond sense, although there's some crossover there. But the idea is you cut off one part of the organization and more parts appear in its place. ISIS is certainly more diverse than that. It's less organized and less structured. And what you see is people who are inspired by ISIS via online radicalization or via their own personal journey of radicalization. They're willing to do things in ISIS's name, even though ISIS would have no connection with them whatsoever. But having said that, every security situation, every country is going to be slightly different, isn't it? America and Australia and places like that are going to be most concerned about homegrown threats, the lone wolf style, the radicalization online. But in Europe, of course, with malleable borders, with more fluid borders, the prospects of people crossing borders to carry out attacks is obviously a much greater threat. So everywhere it has to deal with its own specific issues. And certainly in Europe, there is a significant threat environment at the moment. But that doesn't necessarily translate to the same kind of threat environment in distant places, places separated by ocean.
Luke Howie, Deputy Director of the Global Research Center at Australia's Monash University, talking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. French President François Hollande will meet Tuesday with President Obama as part of a multi-nation tour seeking to spur action against Islamic State militants and push for a political settlement to Syria's civil war. The White House says the two leaders will discuss further cooperation as part of the U.S.-led coalition that's been conducting airstrikes against IS targets in Iraq and Syria for more than a year. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA White House correspondent Arup Pandey about the upcoming talks.
This is the first time that the two men are meeting since those attacks. We saw Kerry travel to Paris and meet there with French officials. But this will really be a time, the White House says, for the U.S. to again show its solidarity and friendship with France. Obama is called the oldest ally of the United States. And when asked during the White House briefing what deliverables will come from this meeting, the White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said he didn't want to downplay the significance of these expressions of solidarity and support. And obviously, the fight against the Islamic State militant group will be front and center. This is part of Hollande's, he met with British Prime Minister Cameron talking about the fight, with Cameron pledging to take the issue of airstrikes in Syria to the British Parliament. From the White House, Hollande will then meet with Putin. And that will also, so he's really trying to see if he can, if everyone can join forces in this fight. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this meeting.
And that meeting with David Cameron, especially important because now we have a more staunch British support in this coalition. The meeting with Putin would be quite interesting because Russia has taken quite a bit of criticism for its involvement in Syria and some of the placements of its airstrikes, which they claimed were against ISIS, but the West is disputes.
That's right. And when asked about Russia, the press secretary at the White House basically said that Russia is undermining efforts to reach a political settlement in Syria. What the White House has repeatedly said, he kind of countered the notion that Russia is trying to peel off some of the coalition members in this anti-ISIL coalition. He's saying, look, the United States has been leading this effort. We've pulled more than our own weight. We're continuing to do so. And basically, we're supporting what some of what France has done, launching its own airstrikes after the Paris attacks. But the White House was pretty critical, as per usual, of Russia and Russia's efforts, saying we haven't really seen a change in their strategy and their until they focus their efforts on the Islamic State. We don't know how much they'll do. And so we welcome their contributions, but if they're willing to change their focus, and so far we haven't seen evidence of that.
White House correspondent Arup Pandey. France is intensifying its attacks on Islamic State targets in Syria. In the aftermath of the deadly Paris attacks, France moved its sole aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle, into position in the Mediterranean on Monday and could use the Cyprus base as an alternate launch base. Media coverage of the Syria conflict tends to focus on the battlefield, but in the midst of war, political activists have managed to set up hundreds of local councils which are trying to provide civilians with basic services. For the councils to keep running, they have to navigate complex politics and negotiate with armed groups. Jamie Detmer has details.
In rebel-controlled parts of war-torn Syria, where the forces of President Bashar al-Assad have been expelled, a new breed of local councillors has emerged, administering what relief they can and responding to people's basic needs. 416 local councils are now functioning in towns and villages across parts of Syria that are under the control of neither the regime of President Bashar al-Assad or Islamic State extremists. In some towns, council officials have been elected in rudimentary run polls. Their work amid Russian and Syrian airstrikes and skirmishes on the ground often leads them to defy Islamist and other rebel militias who want to control civilian as well as military affairs. Many of the councils in rural Aleppo, rural Idlib, and some areas in the countryside of Latakia, as well as in rebel-controlled towns ringing Damascus, originated in local relief efforts. Activists soon realised that with the Assad regime ousted and hardline Islamist militias seeking to exert broad control, they needed to define areas of civilian responsibility and to help provide electricity, water, healthcare and education. Western officials view the council's emergence as a civic breakthrough, one they hope may help to nudge the ideological direction of the rebellion, tempering its sectarianism and curtailing the power of radical Islamists by building up a groundswell of popular support for secular, accountable local governance. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Gaziantep, Turkey.
Coming up, the family farm comes to the city. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
The good news is China's air quality improved in 2015. The bad news is it's still pretty bad for parts of China where a thick haze of smog recently raised alerts in several cities. China's rapid growth over the last three decades is blamed for much of its pollution problems, putting economic concerns over the environment. So far this year, though, China saw a slight improvement after Beijing pledged to put stricter air pollution controls in place. Greenpeace campaigner Dong Liangse says it's a good start.
From the data and the numbers, we can see the air quality in Beijing is improving. But we believe the Chinese government needs to put in place stricter and more efficient measures.
China's air quality is blamed for more than a million deaths every year. The smog is especially bad in the winter, with increases in coal-powered energy for heating. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. Security is tightening in the United States following new videos reportedly released by Islamic State, specifically threatening an attack on New York City and Washington. While security officials work to harden potential targets against any terrorist threats, a growing number of cybersecurity analysts are warning some of the most critical U.S. assets are all but unprotected. They range from water treatment facilities to manufacturing to electric grids. International Edition Susan Yockey spoke with VOA's cybersecurity correspondent Doug Bernard about just how ominous things really are.
There are a lot of cybersecurity analysts out there who indeed are saying some very scary things. What they're talking about specifically are not the sort of security things that we've spoken about often. Our computers being, you know, infected, data being stolen from networks, that sort of thing. This is something very different. It's called OT, operational technology, and it involves the millions upon millions of small devices that control many of our industrial processes. So they're not necessarily used for emailing or for other kinds of things. They're monitoring pressure. They're monitoring temperature, that sort of thing, and making adjustments so that everything works properly. Now, in order for all of these devices to do their job, they need to talk to each other. But many analysts, and I've actually spoken with a number of analysts looking for a counter view, and I couldn't find it. To a last one, they all said these devices are decades old, they were designed before security was even a thought, and they are perhaps the biggest vulnerability facing the United States right now.
When it snows in Washington, the city comes to a standstill. Right. But we still stay home and get on the computers and the phones and have lights, right, and have heat and everything.
Right.
Doesn't this mean that it's a possibility that we could get even more frozen out?
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually a great term. Several high-ranking U.S. officials, in fact, have used that exact scenario. So let's take the power grid, for example. If hacking groups were able to gain access to, let's say several devices, creating actual physical destruction at power generating facilities. So for a period of time, there's no power generated. Those generators contribute to the national electric grid. If you have several of them drop out at once, you could have major portions, say the entire eastern seaboard, power simply fail, not fail for hours or days, but people are saying literally for weeks or months until the equipment is being able to be repaired. That would lead to complete, I think, chaos nationally. Now, that's a worst-case doomsday scenario, but the analysts that I've spoken with all say we need to be thinking about this because, well, one, they say it's not a matter of if, it's simply a matter of when and how bad.
You're going to say there is no cure for this at this time. We got to think of it.
Well, there are cures, but what it takes is serious, concerted effort by governments and by industry to correct these systems. That is a multi-billion-dollar, multi-year process.
VOA cybersecurity correspondent Doug Bernard talking with my colleague Susan Yockey. Time for our daily look at the world of social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to talk about U.S. Republican presidential contender Donald Trump. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
So he is in the hot seat once again. Mm-hmm. What's it all about this time?
It's about an image he tweeted which contains false data about black crime. It alleges that 97% of African Americans were killed by blacks, whereas only 2% of them were killed by whites. It also claims 81% of white victims of murder are killed by blacks, and only 16% by whites. So it's not surprising that some people criticize his tweet as race baiting. The information is attributed to the Crime Statistics Bureau in San Francisco and reflects this year's data.
So how do we come to figure that the information is false?
Oh, where do I begin? So for one thing, there's no such institution called a Crime Statistics Bureau. So here's a tip for anyone who aspires to run for president. If you have never heard of an organization, look it up before quoting it. Also, it's only November. How can we have a 2015 data already?
Well, that's a good point. It makes sense. We're not at the end of the year. It sometimes takes months to analyze data from the previous year. The federal government, G, conducts the same study every year. So what's last year's data looking like?
Well, the FBI is in charge of the data, and in 2014, 14% of white Americans were killed by black Americans, not 81%. And more than 82% of whites were killed by other whites, not 16%, like Trump's false image argued.
So both whites and blacks were mostly murdered by other whites and blacks.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of response is this controversial tweet getting?
A reply from the University of Chicago's professor Harold Pollack is getting a lot of likes. He's on Twitter at Harold Pollack. He tweeted, "Your figure to the right is incorrect." The bar graph that he tweeted shows correct FBI figures for 2011 homicides. And that data shows similar results like the one I just told you, with roughly 80% of both white and black victims killed by their own kind. Ray?
Thanks, G. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA underscore IE and on her own account at G Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. If you live in the city, you can still have a family farm. That's the message some experts are saying who are promoting gardening in small places. They believe that while urban farming has its limits, it does not have to be limiting. Faith Lapidus explains.
It's time to cook dinner, and all the vegetables that Sherry Miles Cohen is adding to the meal came from her garden. Miles Cohen is a psychologist, wife, and mother. And since her family moved to this house in Washington last year, she's added gardener to her titles.
When I was a kid, my aunt had a garden, and she grew sort of staples, greens and potatoes and onions. And I've always loved sort of getting my hands dirty in the soil.
Inspired by her aunt, she planted a variety of vegetables.
We have tomatoes and eggplant and okra, sweet peppers, every kind of green you can imagine. I've had to become sort of more creative with recipes. So I spend a lot of time on the internet trying to look up recipes for the vegetables that have been really prolific, like the eggplant.
Miles Cohen gets help twice a month from gardening coach Natalie Carver from the garden design company Love and Carrots.
And here we're growing out of raised beds, so there's the structure with the soil, and we really try to plant every square foot. A lot of our favorite summer vegetables, you know, all of our tomatoes and, you know, basil, all the things that people want out of their garden, they need lots of sun.
Planting vegetables in small spaces, urban gardening in general, is a growing trend, says Meredith Shepherd, who founded Love and Carrots.
People are
interested in where their food comes from these days. They're interested in eating really healthily, and they might not trust what they're buying in the grocery store anymore, so they want to grow it themselves. And I read a statistic that something like 70% of Americans are gardening these days, and it's growing at a rate of 20% since 2009, so it's really just taking off. A lot of it has been historically young women who are mostly interested in gardening, but I think the young men are catching up.
Shepherd helps her clients find creative ways to grow their favorite vegetables, no matter how small their garden is.
If you have a wall that's nice and sunny, we'll put a nice sturdy trellis up the wall and grow something like beans or cucumbers or peas. Make use of that vertical space and then have other things spilling over the front of the gardens. And on a balcony, we'd use some containers. We've even used 5-gallon buckets.
Galiza Hutchinson grows her vegetables in a tiny garden in front of her townhouse. She says she gets the best flavor and variety, and it's cheaper.
I don't go grocery shopping for vegetables at all, so 100% of my vegetables come from my garden.
Hutchinson, who was born in Zambia and grew up in the United States, says her small garden means a lot to her.
My dad was a farmer, and so that was the major reason why I was looking to settle down in a place that I could. I still enjoy being in an urban environment, but I also missed out on feeling being a part of, you know, nature, the environment.
For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Loretta Lynn is known as the First Lady of Country Music. She's receiving a new award in honor of her many decades of country hits. International edition Sarah Williams speaks with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about this latest tribute.
The 2015 Billboard Women in Music Awards takes place December 11th in New York City. It's a ceremony that's continuing to develop and grow. This year, they've added a new award, the first ever Billboard Women in Music Legend Award. Country icon Loretta Lynn will be its first recipient. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk about it. Nikki, this is a huge honor. Tell us about Loretta Lynn's legacy.
Okay, Loretta is awesome. She's a trailblazer. Her work is marked with fearlessness and honesty. She became a part of the country music scene in the 1960s. Now, as a songwriter, she wrote about whatever she wanted, as long as it spoke to other women, and many of her songs were autobiographical. So her songs focused a lot on blue-collar women's issues. She talked about cheating men and persistent mistresses, both of which she dealt with in her marriage. She wrote about many things that were considered scandalous, too. She sang about birth control in her song The Pill, double standards for men and women being widowed after the draft during the Vietnam War in her song, for example, Dear Uncle Sam, she talked about or sang about the loss of teenage virginity. Consequently, many country radio stations actually banned her music. But she continued to persevere, and she became one of the major legends who continued to lay the groundwork for many of the country artists that you see today, female and otherwise. In 1976, she released her autobiography, Coal Miner's Daughter. It became the number one bestseller, making her the first country music artist to make the New York Times bestseller list. This opened the door for tons of other country artists to write books. And then in 1980, her autobiography, The Coal Miner's Daughter, became an Oscar-winning film. And in the early 1980s, she became the first American female recording artist to chart over 50 top 10 hits. She has been inducted. I mean, it's extensive. She's been inducted into more music halls of fame than any other female recording artist. In 2010, she received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award for her 50 years in country music. President Barack Obama honored her with a Presidential Medal of Freedom. She was also a recipient of the Kennedy Center Honor in 2003, and she is also the first female country artist to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1977. So the awards, the honors, the hit songs are extensive. And her partnership, I would be remiss if I didn't include this. Her partnership with Conway Twitty was quite prosperous and filled with tons of accomplishments as well. They are the most successful and most awarded male-female duet team in country music history.
Now, she's about to release a new CD as well.
Yeah, I think this is perfect timing. So this will be her first solo album in more than 10 years. It's called Full Circle. It's set to drop March 4th. It'll be a little bit of the old and a little bit of the new. According to a press release, the project takes listeners on a journey through Loretta's musical story, from the Appalachian folk songs and gospel music she learned as a child to new interpretations of her classic hits and country standards to songs newly written for the project. So I know it includes a duet with Willie Nelson and a song with Elvis Costello. Also, on the same day that Full Circle is released, a new documentary about her life and career is going to air on PBS. It's called American Masters, Loretta Lynn, Still a Mountain Girl. So that will happen March 4th as well. And Full Circle is now available on pre-order, too.
Well, you can hear more about country music with Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Holler. We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing that Daddy made.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is violence directed against women because they are women, or violence that affects primarily women and girls. They are human rights violations committed against women that stem from discrimination and gender inequality, and the failure of governments and societies to recognize the human rights of women and girls. Globally, over one-third of women and girls experience some form of physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. Violence against women takes many forms and goes far beyond rape and physical intimidation. Every girl who was married off too young, every wife who was beaten by her husband or in-laws, every woman or girl who was trafficked into sexual exploitation is a victim of gender-based violence. Girls and women who are subjected to sexual violence in war zones, honor killing, psychological abuse, such as harassment and intimidation, are victims of gender-based violence. All forms of gender-based violence are unacceptable violations of human rights, but together they form an enormous obstacle to gender equality, economic development, security, and true human progress. The 2 weeks between November 25th, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and December 10th, Human Rights Day, are dedicated to 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. 16 days of campaigning around the world to challenge and raise awareness of gender-based violence and mobilizing people everywhere to bring about change. This year's theme is From Peace in the Home to Peace in the World, Make Education Safe for All. The root causes of violence against women and girls include gender stereotypes, perceived gender roles, and social norms. These perceptions are formed early in childhood. Only through education can we hope to change them. This means that girls and women must be able to obtain an education so they and their children can lead better lives. It means creating a safe, hygienic school environment for them and removing obstacles that cut their education short, such as domestic work or early marriage. And it means that boys and men must be taught to engage in preventing violence against women and promoting gender equality. Gender-based violence is not inevitable. It is a choice. It can and must be prevented, and the time is now.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's the universal time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this late.